Strategy and Insider, exploring future trends and their impacts.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to a special episode of the Strategy and Insider podcast. Today, we're recording live from one of the firm's new flagship events, the PwC and Strategy and Future of Health Forum. This exclusive gathering brings together actually senior leaders, innovators, and executives from across the entire healthcare ecosystem. Through panel discussions and keynotes, we're highlighting the importance of interconnected healthcare systems, but also people-centered models. And even though this event is exclusive to healthcare decision makers, we are excited to give you, our really dear podcast listeners, an exclusive insight in some of the topics we are discussing. And I'm therefore excited to record this episode today directly from the event. And I will introduce you to two renowned healthcare professionals who have also joined us as panelists at the forum and who will highlight two pharma and healthcare topics in brief segments. So please join me for insightful conversations with Lucy Jones, who is the Chief Clinical Officer at Oviva, and Ashton Harper, who is the Global Medical Lead for Neurosciences at Roche Diagnostics. Lucy, a really warm welcome to you. It's great to have you with me today. And before we start with our conversation, let me briefly introduce you. You're actually the Chief Clinical Officer at Oviva, which is a European virtual clinic for weight-related conditions that blends technology with personalized coaching to help people make sustainable lifestyle changes. Lucy is actually an experienced dietitian who has worked in numerous London-based hospitals, and initially she earned her bachelor's degree in human nutrition and dietetics from London Metropolitan University, followed by a master's in clinical research from the University of Manchester and a diploma from the National Centre for Eating Disorders. Our listeners from the UK probably also know her as a widely recognized dietitian and media spokesperson, as she regularly appears on British TV, radio, and in print media to provide expert nutrition insights. So again, thanks for taking the time.
What a lovely intro. Thank you very much for having me.
Hey, Lucy, on your LinkedIn profile, you have highlighted the stark contrast you experienced between the world of TV and the realities of delivering care in health system on the ground where resources are much more scarce. How did that inspire you to develop solutions that really enable frequent expert support and scalable, high-quality interventions? And probably you could also elaborate a bit how Oviva in itself supports patients and clients remotely.
I started working on the television as early in my 20s, actually, and I was really fortunate to be screen tested with a lot of other kind of media spokespeople from the British Dietetic Association, and that's how I got picked up for my first presenting job. Until then, I'd had quite a traditional introduction to a dietetics career and worked in hospitals with crazy caseloads and running around from outpatient clinics in chronic disease to supporting kind of older care wards internally. And as you say, it had been quite a frustrating experience because in outpatients, people were pretty lucky if they could come and see me every 3 months. They'd forget everything that we'd gone through last time. Life would have happened. Things get delayed. And you'd never really see the potential of the interventions that you were doing with people. It was always a little bit untapped. And that was, of course, more frustrating for them than it was me, because they were investing their time, traveling to hospital, going and seeing an expert, and not really seeing those tangible health improvements. So it came to this completely stark contrast when I presented a program called The Food Hospital, where people would come in with all manner of conditions and they would see myself and a doctor, and we'd set them on a plan and they'd go away. But of course, that wasn't the end of it, because we had an off-screen dietitian that was following up with them every day, making sure that they were implementing it, problem-solving where they need it. So people would come back a month later, just completely transformed. Symptoms gone, off meds, disease trajectory completely transformed. And it just opened my eyes to just how much untapped potential there was in behaviour change and lifestyle interventions for chronic disease management. People don't not make changes because they don't know what to do. the reason that people can't sustain behavior change is because the support isn't there for when life gets complicated, when something happens, when there is a barrier in their way. That's the bit that people need help with. And that's what we've really tried to generate at Oviva. So Oviva is just a provider of chronic care services. So we support patients with obesity, type 2 diabetes, hypertension. Mm-hmm. It's always free at the point of access because we believe that care should be based on somebody's clinical need, not on their ability to pay. So we work with the health system in each of the markets that we work. We accept referrals from doctors, and then we will support patients in a period of care. And that's usually up to about 2 years in the UK. It can be ongoing in Germany under the kind of DiGA formation.
DiGA.
And we get patients on our medical device app because it's a behavior change tool. They're logging each thing that they're eating through the day. They're getting instant feedback from our AI, as well as this kind of build up into a daily nutrition feedback. So over a day, it will tell them if they're having too much sugar, if they're not eating enough fiber, are they getting enough protein? And it will instantly give them hints about types of meals, recipes that they can do to optimize their nutrition intake. So they're not having to wait weeks to hear from one of our coaches. They're getting instant AI feedback at the moment that they're eating, at the moment that they're moving. And that's really driving the behavior change. So it means that when you have those just-in-time interventions with one of our clinicians, they're building on what the technology is already doing. And you're getting then much more consistent behavior change and therefore much better outcomes for patients over 6 to 12 months.
Fascinating. So it's really kind of a real-time continuous companion that you give to those patients, I assume.
Yeah, exactly that.
So weight management remains obviously a challenge for many, as we know. And this is influenced also by genetics, health conditions, lifestyle factors and the like. And GLP-1 meds have shown promise for weight loss, but can also increase the risk of nutritional deficiencies for imbalanced nutritions that can affect then energy levels, metabolism, immunity, cognition, and also long-term bone and muscle health. So nutrition-dense food can also help prevent these deficiencies and support long-term health, as we know. How can those evidence-based, digitally delivered nutrition care support weight loss guidances that you referenced before help safeguard nutritions of those people that are actually on a GLP-1 drug in the moment of care, in the moment of treatment, but also longer-term ones off the drug?
So GLP-1s are transformative for obesity, and they work really just by drumming down somebody's desire to eat. So their appetite drops, they do not feel that pull or drive to eat through the day. Now, if you then don't have structured behavioral support around it, what generally happens is somebody eats much less frequently. Mm-hmm. And they'll eat much smaller amounts when they do eat. Both of those sound great, right? When you're managing obesity.
At a first sight.
Yes, exactly. But you're right that you're missing that bit, that it's not necessarily transforming what they're eating. So it's becoming more nutritious. And what we know is that obesity isn't just the excess of calories. Actually, people living with obesity have a much higher risk of pre-existing nutritional deficiencies. So people living with obesity, more than half of them have nutritional deficiencies before they've even started treatment. And that ranges from things like B vitamins, selenium, vitamin D, vitamin A, right through the kind of micronutrient spectrum. So, of course, if you've got pre-existing nutritional deficiencies and then suddenly someone starts eating much, much less, it's a recipe for disaster. So what we've got within the Oviva app is we have AI image recognition. So all they have to do is take a photo of what they're eating and it instantly knows what's on the plate and how much is there. Mm-hmm. And so in the background, it's doing that full nutritional analysis and it can display to the patient, what do you need to eat more of in this day in order to end up to the point where you're nutritionally optimized? And it can then provide hints and tips. And let's be honest, you can't get all of your nutritional quality if you're only going to eat once a day. It's almost impossible to get enough protein, enough fiber. It's not going to happen. So one of the things we have to do is to nudge and prompt patients when perhaps they're not feeling hungry, because that's what the medication's helping them with, of actually having small, regular, nutritious meals that are not overwhelming, but are going to meet their nutritional needs. And that's how we safeguard nutrition.
And can I just ask on that GLP-1, because it truly is a game changer in obesity management. Still, it's not made for a chronic usage forever, for everybody, right? So let's talk also behavioral science in a way. What do you see from your work, from the data that you have, are really workable behavioral strategies that are most effective for sustainable weight management in a real-world setting? Because let's face it, we're humans, we're lazy. We know in principle that we should eat better, sleep more, do more exercise, and off we go. We're in a good shape, we're in a good health status, right? But it's not happening. So from your real-world understanding and data points, what's most effective to change people at scale in a society where obviously there is the top 5% that anyway do it, right? But then there is the mass of people that don't do it.
Lots to unpick there, Thomas. The first thing that I want to challenge is that these medications are not designed for long-term chronic use, because I would say absolutely they are. It's just not the way they're being implemented. And when you look at the data that the pharma companies have produced, they are producing long-term data of consistent usage and showing benefits at 5 years on cardiometabolic outcomes. But that's on consistent usage. And you're absolutely right. The way that it's been adopted in the real world is that people are expecting it to take it for a few months, get some weight off, and then instantly stop. And what the evidence is showing us is that when they stop, they regain weight. And we've only got kind of 30 to 40% retention, even up to 12 months. You know, that's how many are going through into the second year of treatment. So what we're getting are these short episodes of care for which actually we don't have the evidence that that's even particularly helpful in terms of long-term cardiometabolic health at all. We're really implementing it in a way that hasn't been tested by the evidence base. When we look at trying to support people on sustaining outcomes, there's a few things that the evidence base has shown us is really important. Nutritional mix, so getting higher protein, slightly lower carb compositions. And I'm not talking keto, I'm just talking kind of having less than a quarter of your plate as complex carbohydrates. If you can move people to that kind of balance, they do better in terms of longer term weight maintenance. We've got data there for that. Arguably, the more critical point is movement. And if you can get somebody so that they're active an hour a day, it's as good as liraglutide for weight maintenance. It's very effective. However, you're right. You've kind of got that top 5% that are willing to do an hour of activity a day. For most other people, that's a real struggle. So our job is to find what are the low-hanging fruits
the
that we can...
The nudges you need to give, right?
Exactly. Yeah. How can we implement incidental exercise? Incidental exercise is when you take the stairs rather than taking the escalator. Mm-hmm. Or when you park at the other side of the car park to give yourself that two-minute walk. Building in those micro moments of 2 to 3 minutes of exercise through a day is actually much more achievable for most people. And we train people to do that with strength exercise. So whilst you're boiling the kettle, hold down a squat or do some calf raises. So in the moment or when the adverts are on the television. So if you can train people to micro adopt smaller episodes of movement, and you can do that with AI and nudges and having a digital companion, then you can build up larger behavior change without somebody feeling like they need to go to a gym for an hour. And that's the advantage of having digital tools that are AI enabled. I think the other thing that we've really got to get people to move away from is this this boom and bust. I'm on a diet, I'm off a diet. All of us, whether we like to accept it or not, are on a health journey. Some of us are on a passive health journey. Some of us are being more active in that health journey, but we're all on a journey with our health.
Very true.
And the minute that you help somebody to realize that they're not on a diet or off a diet, we're always on a diet, we are always eating, we are always moving, being more conscious and active in that process allows you to take accountability for the things that you want to put in for your health. There is no start and end.
Fascinating, honestly, and thanks for sharing this. Truly, truly inspiring, those insights. It's really been a pleasure learning about your work and your vision for the future of nutrition and a healthy lifestyle.
Thank you for having
Thank
me.
Thank you. A very warm welcome to Dr. Ashton Harper, who is the Global Medical Affairs Lead for Neurosciences at Roche Diagnostics. In his capacity at Roche, he heads a team of professionals that is responsible for clinical research with a particular focus on neurological diseases. Ashton actually studied medicine at the University College London and graduated in physiology and pharmacology. He practiced as a physician in the NHS and trained as a gastrointestinal surgeon. eventually becoming a member of the Royal College of Surgeons. And in 2015, he transitioned to the life sciences industry and now brings more than a decade of medical affairs experience. So that said, I'm really looking forward to our conversation, and thanks that you took the time when coming off the panel and moving into here, and we're already doing the next format together. So thanks.
Of course, happy to.
So as said, you are a trained physician who turned into a pharma executive. What actually motivated you to leave surgery for medical affairs? And how did your first role at the UK microbiome focused biotech in 2015 that you joined shape your further career path?
Yeah, you're not the first person to ask this question.
I guess so.
Yeah. So, yeah, I think it was serendipity, really. You know, it followed a conversation that I had with a senior colleague whilst I was training in surgery. I spoke to a senior colleague. I was interested in doing a PhD in cancer surgery, and during that conversation, he asked me, "Had I ever considered?" We were talking about research. And he said, have you ever considered a role in pharmaceutical medicine? And I have to be honest that I never knew it existed. But he connected me with a friend of his who had made that transition a few years previously. And I just had this fantastic conversation with this individual, very, very bright and engaged, inspiring person. And one of the things that she said that really stuck with me and I reflected on afterwards was that, you know, as a clinician on the front line or as a surgeon, you're helping people. It's very rewarding, but you're only helping necessarily a small number that you might come into contact with.
True.
And what she was saying that was particularly rewarding going into industry is that you could be working on a medicine or a medical technology that has the potential to revolutionize the diagnosis and management of diseases and potentially impact thousands, if not maybe millions of people. And I thought that was a really captivating concept, you know. And then so following that, she put me in contact with a few recruitment agents, and I was referred to a book as well about roles for physicians in industry. And again, very, very interesting to read about that. And it really opened this door to something that I never knew existed. And then, you know, I actually kind of forgot about things and I just went back to surgery. But 6 months later, I got contacted about this job opportunity working for Protexin, this microbiome company. And I started reading about it. And in fact, there's another area that I didn't know anything about, really, microbiome. And I remember sort of ravenously sort of going through the literature in this space. There's so many interesting high tier publications in, you know, Nature, Cell on this, and talking about how the gut microbiome impacts, you know, all kinds of other systems, you know, cardiovascular health, brain health, etc. And I was very, very interested in this. And then I went along for the interview, and I really got on with the people there with the company, and they offered me the job the next day. And you know, it was scary. You know, everything up until that point, I had completely dedicated to a life in surgery, and studied for many years. And it was a big sort of leap of faith, yeah. I suppose. And my consultant at the time thought I was kind of crazy with the fact that I was leaving. But I've never sort of shied away from adventure, you know, taking on a new opportunity. So I decided to sort of take the plunge. And you know, I think it was the right decision for me. Working for that company, it really enabled me to sort of cut my teeth in medical affairs, it developed my ability to critically appraise you know, academic literature, to design, implement clinical research studies, manage a budget, manage a team as well in industry. So it was really, really rewarding. It also enabled me to travel the world. I went and lectured to doctors all across the world, and also then understand how healthcare systems work in different parts of the world as well. So it was fantastic. Yeah. And, you know, the thing is, I do miss surgery. I do miss clinical practice. Uh-huh. There's something very special about connecting with patients. And, you know, particularly surgery, there are times when somebody's life is in your hands, you know, critical cases where if it wasn't for you, you know, somebody wouldn't be living today. And that is incredibly special and rewarding to be part of that. Mm. And there's nothing that really compares to it. But, you know, I really love what I'm doing now. And I think it's a really fascinating time or position to be in this interface between bench and bedside of cutting edge technologies. And, you know, working from that early R&D phase through to developing evidence to enable the adoption of innovations to transform healthcare. And so it's fantastic. And Roche is a wonderful company. You ask anyone at Roche, there's such a great culture there. And it's just full of, you know, really bright, science-driven, patient-focused individuals, and it's a pleasure to work there. So I think I made the right decision.
No, I would definitely sign up to your last statement that you made. Very true. And I mean, next to hearing that you wanted to scale your impact at the very get-go, there is a lot of curiosity that I'm hearing into kind of throwing yourself into something new, right? Probably pivoting back to the job that you're having now, which is in the neuroscience space. I mean, as the global population ages, neurological disorders such as Alzheimer's are obviously on the rise. And to date, Alzheimer's, for instance, can only be diagnosed through a doctor's consultation, through physical examination, psychometric tests such as the minimal mental status test, as well as imaging techniques such as MRI scans and the like. This makes the diagnosis not only very expensive, but also invasive and time-consuming. So Roche is now developing various blood-based tests to diagnose Alzheimer's at an earlier stage with a less invasive methods and probably also a bit more scalability through this. Could you share to the extent possible the current status of this program and give us a kind of a sneak peek into other neuroscience innovations you and your team up soon?
Yeah, certainly. Maybe I should just start by saying, you know, there's many unmet needs in the patient pathway, the diagnostic pathway for Alzheimer's today. And just to give you a few stats, globally, it's thought that 75% of people that are symptomatic with dementia are currently living without a diagnosis. Sure. And those who do receive a diagnosis might wait 2 to 3 years. And there's many reasons for that. There's stigma around this condition that prevents patients and families from seeking that first point of contact with the healthcare system. But there's also this reliance still on these subjective cognitive tests, these pen and paper tests. And actually, at the very early stages of disease symptomaticities, they're quite blunt instruments. They lack sensitivity. And this leads to patients being, you know, misdiagnosed or underdiagnosed. And until, you know, quite recently, the means of definitively diagnosing patients has been with CSF, cerebrospinal fluid. This involves an invasive lumbar puncture procedure or PET CT. And both of these are very expensive and time consuming. And just to give you some stats from the UK, only about 2% of eligible patients are receiving these definitive diagnostic tests today. So there's a huge issue with access. And what is desperately needed is accurate, minimally invasive tests that can be introduced broadly to enable early definitive diagnosis for patients. And that's where, you know, blood-based biomarkers come in. And I'm pleased to say this year has been the first year, well, we launched the first European regulated blood-based biomarker, which has been a massive breakthrough.
Absolutely. Yeah. And still congrats to that,
yeah,
of course.
Thank you very much. Thanks. p-tau181, and it also has FDA approval as well. You know, this is a huge breakthrough. This particular biomarker, it's very sensitive, which means that in a low prevalence setting, that means like in primary care, where those that are coming seeking attention for cognitive impairment, probably only about maybe 20, 25% of them, Alzheimer's will be the underlying cause. So we would call that sort of a low prevalence setting versus specialist care, which is higher prevalence, maybe 50%. You get this concentration of patients. So in a low prevalence setting, this test has very high, what we call negative predictive value, which basically means if you test negative on it, it's very unlikely that Alzheimer's is the cause of your cognitive impairment. And what that enables the clinician to do is say, well, we've ruled that out as the most common cause of dementia. We can explore other potential reasons. So that might be depression, obstructive sleep apnea, maybe vitamin deficiencies, etc. And what we're hoping is that is going to provide some efficiencies in the pathways and reduce the number of unnecessary referrals onto specialist care to reduce the burden on specialist care. Another one that we have that's coming out next year, we're looking to launch the first half of next year, is p-tau217. And this biomarker actually has a number of advantages over p-tau181 as a more definitive test for specialist care. And then the last thing I should say, you know, you're asking about other developments. Something that's very cool is that the Neuro Toolkit. And so this is a collaborative initiative that involves academia, industry, and philanthropy partners. And really what its goal is to generate novel, high-quality, neurology-focused biomarker data to advance the research and development of diagnostic and treatment solutions. And it basically what it is a collection, a panel of about, it's dynamic, so it's always changing, but at the moment it's about 20 plasma biomarkers, novel plasma biomarkers, and about 15 CSF biomarkers. And there's 4 international NTK NeuroToolkit certified labs, and they can perform this testing. And so if you're a researcher and you've got a cohort and you've got some blood blood tests, CSF tests, you can analyze this massive panel on those biomarkers. And what's also really cool is that there's a digital research environment that's part of this initiative. So it's a collaborative sort of cloud-based platform with data analytic apps. So it enables global researchers to study, compare, and analyze cohorts on an international basis. And this is really helping to accelerate the development of biomarker data in neurology. So this isn't just about Alzheimer's. This is also the engine driving real paradigm shift in the diagnosis and management of neurological diseases in general. So we're also looking at multiple sclerosis, Parkinson's disease, traumatic brain injury, other causes of dementia, like frontotemporal dementia, Lewy body dementia as well. So,
and I mean, we are here now in Frankfurt together, right, for 2 days to discuss the future of health and to distill the art of the possible, but also the doable, and get a realistic perspective of what we can jointly achieve if we really work across the industry sectors and converge our interests. One of the greatest hopes and promises that we are also hearing is that in neurodegenerative or other fatal diseases, they can actually be at some point cured, if not even prevented. And next to cancer, Alzheimer's certainly is one of these that are really kind of fatal and difficult to bear in society. Mm-hmm. Do you believe at some point these diseases can actually be cured? And if so, when do you foresee a leapfrog success in those treatments?
Yeah. It's a really critical question. And this is being explored at the moment. I should maybe just differentiate cure from prevention. So if we think about cure, I think once a patient, let's say with Alzheimer's, is symptomatic, is in the dementia phases of the illness, that means that there's already been a significant loss of brain cells that, due to these toxic buildup of proteins. And I think to say, could you cure one of these individuals, would mean, you know, not only removing all that sort of toxic proteins, amyloid tau, but then you would have to sort of somehow regenerate those lost brain cells. And I don't think at the moment with our current technologies we're able to do that. Maybe some point in the future, but I think that would be a little bit impossible at the moment. Prevention, on the other hand, and it's a bit more complex, and really prevention is sort of split into three sort of sections. But I think where we are at the moment with these new disease modifying therapies, these new monoclonal antibodies, we're in tertiary prevention. So this means that you're identifying a disease, but somebody's symptomatic. And by giving this treatment, you can delay, if only for a small amount of time, you can delay that progression. You can prevent it from getting worse for some time. So that's where we are at the moment. I think what's really exciting is the sort of secondary and primary prevention. And so secondary would be identifying this disease in asymptomatic individuals. And there's a number of medicines at the moment that are under investigation to explore just this. And I think, you know, that is going to be very, very exciting. So you try to identify individuals that are high risk, and you perform these biomarker testings to see if they're eligible for this treatment. And then the next step, of course, is so primary prevention. That would be identifying, trying to prevent this disease from ever occurring again in asymptomatic individuals. So there we're thinking about maybe vaccines. Mm. So like mRNA vaccines potentially. And again, there's a number of those under investigation for Alzheimer's. And that would be, you know, that would be completely game changing, and it would totally prevent these diseases from occurring.
So really super exciting innovation ahead, both in diagnostics, but also in the treatments in the neuroscience space. And we heard also from other panelists and colleagues joining us here. So Ashton, sincere thank you for taking the time aside from all the networking outside, where we're jumping back in a second. Really enjoyed the conversation, and yeah, hoping for the very best that those innovations will flourish and come to market soon.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
So that's it for today. I'm expected back on stage for my next panel discussion. But before leaving there, a huge thank you to Lucy and Ashton for joining me in this special recording at the Future of Health Forum. For me, this was an exciting change from our usual format, as we highlighted two healthcare trends in concise segments. Question back to you is what you actually think, whether this can become a recurring format. I do welcome your feedback on LinkedIn as always. That said, goodbye for now, take care, and stay safe.
Strategy and Strategy made real.